Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us again today. Really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Wow, where do we even start? There's just so much to talk about when it comes to coronavirus and COVID-19. Over the next hour, we'll talk with a local person who's recovering from COVID-19, and we'll talk with researchers at St. Louis University and Washington University Schools of Medicine about their efforts to find a possible treatment for COVID-19. But first, let's get the show started the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us again.
Happy to.
Late Friday afternoon, President Trump unveiled the CDC's new policy regarding face coverings.
The CDC is announcing additional steps Americans can take to defend against the transmission of the virus. From recent studies, we know that the transmission from individuals without symptoms is playing a more significant role in the spread of the virus than previously understood. So you don't seem to have symptoms and it still gets transferred. In light of these studies, the CDC is advising the use of non-medical cloth face covering as an additional voluntary public health measure. So it's voluntary. You don't have to do it. They suggest it for a period of time, but this is voluntary. I don't think I'm going to be doing it, but you have a lot of ways you can look at it as follows. The CDC is recommending that Americans wear a basic cloth or fabric mask. They can be either purchased online or simply made at home, probably material that you'd have at home. These face coverings can be easily washed or reused. I want to emphasize that the CDC is not recommending the use of medical grade or surgical grade masks, and we want that to be used for our great medical people that are working so hard and doing some job.
Dr. Buchholz, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm not sure what the right word I have is. Ambivalent is probably the best, and here's why. I think it's perfectly fine. I think the most important thing here in this whole process is really social distancing or spacing people out. So I think using masks without this in place is kind of a shortcut that I'm not really sure is going to have the benefit that we want or need it to have. Clearly, the spacing of everybody out is really what's been driving improvement. We've seen it in other countries. We've seen in states that have adopted this, and hopefully, you know, we see it in our own region where we've adopted this almost 2 weeks ago now. So I think that by far is the most important thing and has been shown to work. Masks probably have a benefit. And I always think of things as risk versus benefits, and the harms of masks seem to be pretty small, although there's some things to think about. You know, I think a couple of things that have been floated out there, you know, the surgical masks, the ones that you'll see healthcare providers and surgeons and all kinds of people in the healthcare setting wear are certainly better than cloth by a good margin. So anything out there that says that cloth masks are superior to, you know, like a handkerchief or something somebody makes is better than that is not factually based. I think, too, nobody really knows is, you know, none of us are used to wearing cloth masks if that's what we're wearing. And so there's a lot of inadvertent touching of the face, and there's some downsides to that as well that nobody's really sure what the net benefit or gain of this is. But I think overall the risk is fairly small. Really what they help with, in my opinion, and I think others have said this too, is that they probably prevent you spreading it to somebody else should you be infected rather than it protecting you. So if a lot of people are wearing this kind of a societal norm, there's probably a benefit. But the bigger benefit, again, like I said, is the spacing. And you know, I wish that would be the focus of the national policy. If everybody's wearing face masks and everybody's still mingling and riding subways and going to places that are well-populated, I don't think the face masks provide much benefit. We've got to kind of, you know, do this in a multi-pronged approach. And I think in terms of prioritization, the universal face masking is less. That's in a public setting. In a healthcare setting, I'm a big proponent for it. The problem is that we have such supply issues that implementing this carries a lot of logistical issues. And that's, I mean, my goodness, the amount of work the leaders above me that have had to do to kind of implement such a policy is just, it's out of this world how complicated it is. And that remains a massive, massive concern, because I think a big question mark with all this is how much is this spread within the healthcare setting? Just, we've got to go see patients. We've got to go provide care for some very ill people. How do we prevent ourselves from either becoming asymptomatic carriers? And when I say ourselves, I'm talking about healthcare providers, nurses, physicians, respiratory therapists, you know, anybody that has to go in and see the patient and care for them, how are we ensuring that we're not spreading it to others? And that remains a massive, massive concern. And I think we need to provide more focus. I'd rather the focus be on public policy to cause separation and in public policy to really make sure the supplies are needed for our healthcare workers. It's been a consistent problem. You see it in New York. We see traces of it here in St. Louis. We see it all across the country. That's really where I wish the efforts would go.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. I guess one thing about the face coverings, I would think, Dr. Buchholz, is that when people put them on, they shouldn't get this false sense of security.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the biggest worry I have, is people have it on and go out and go about their normal daily business. That's killer, literally. And I think this is my biggest concern. There are people out there that, you know, I went to the grocery store yesterday and saw a lot of employees wearing their face masks. I totally get it. I know they're concerned and they have to work and they're in a public area. You know, I'm not that sensitive about that, or maybe that's again the wrong word. I absolutely understand why they're doing that, and I don't have an objection to that at all. And I think it's I wouldn't say encourage it, but I have no problem with them doing that, worried about their own safety and frankly preventing the spread if they were symptomatic of or asymptomatic carriers of spreading on others in a public area. So that I understand, but I think if you have the option of staying at home or sheltering in place, and you're not wearing a face mask and thinking that's equivalent, that's a huge, that is not correct. And that is not what I would recommend at all.
So if I'm understanding you properly, Dr. Buchholz, it would seem that face coverings and face masks are just a small tool in the toolbox to prevent COVID-19. The biggest tool, I guess, would be social distancing. And that would lead me to the question, what do you think of a national stay-at-home order?
I'm a big proponent of that. If you look at the early information coming out of some of the states implemented this early, so California, for instance, so the chair of medicine at University of California, San Francisco, and take the politics out of this or whatever, I mean, it's you know, one of the best hospitals in the country. You know, California implemented a state shelter-in-place order, I don't know the exact date, it's over 2 weeks ago now. And they're starting to see kind of a plateau of cases. Now, could that be because we're not testing enough or there are other issues at play? Sure. But at University of California, San Francisco, they've had a pretty consistent number of COVID cases that they've taken care of. It's been manageable for them. It's stressful and it's taxed their system. And again, there's probably some other factors at play. It's a very well-run hospital and a good organization. So those factors are all there too. But you know, they haven't certainly seen a huge spike or seen the experience that New York has seen. Now, it remains to be seen, and maybe that changes, but, you know, it certainly is a good early indication of such a policy having an effect. And that's what we're looking for. I'm hopeful and I'm kind of curious, you know, this weekend we'll see kind of the 2 weeks of our shelter-in-place order in the city and county of St. Louis. Will that have effect? You know, it's obviously a smaller geographic region than the state of California, but, you know, does that have effect locally and how do those numbers bear out? And, you know, I'm curious to see that. I think by the end of next week, we may have a sense of where that's going. That's the playbook. That's the playbook other countries have followed. it works. And so I think we are now the epicenter. And when I say we, I'm talking about this country, the United States. I'd rather than focus on that than focus on this masking policy, which is, I think, it's taking a slingshot to a machine gun battle. It's not what we need.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot. Really do appreciate it. Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. When we come back, we'll talk with a local person who's recovering from COVID-19. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Thanks for joining us. I wanted to take some time today to talk with a person who's recovering from COVID-19. We've been talking for weeks about coronavirus and what it does to people. So here's our chance to get a firsthand account of the illness and what it does to the body. I'm joined now on the phone by a member of our Entercom St. Louis family, Mike Ferguson. Mike has a weekend show at one of our sister stations, KFTK, and fills in from time to time as a talk show host on KMOX. Mike, thanks for joining us.
I am glad to be here. Glad we can talk about this because people need some reminders right now, Fred.
Yeah. So first off, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's been over a week now since I've been out of the hospital, and the last 3 or 4 days have been pretty good. I can honestly say I feel pretty good, and that's nice to say after a few weeks.
Take us back to the start of this. How do you think you got it?
Looking at the timeline, I took a trip up to Chicago a few weeks ago just kind of took a few days off and bummed around downtown. And looking at the timeline, it's most likely I was probably exposed there. Who knows, at a restaurant or at a blues music club or a, sports museum, wherever it was. And then I went to Columbia and Jeff City to do some radio work out there. And I guess it's possible I could have been exposed there. But most likely it's just a random exposure, probably the wrong handrail I touched in Chicago. And then when I was in mid-Missouri, that's when the symptoms first started. And less than a week after that, I was admitted to the hospital.
What were your symptoms?
For me, it was a really aggressive upper respiratory cough that just wouldn't stop, and fever, and just extreme sweating for me. And the coughing caused a lot of problems, as I later found out, was told by the doctors and nurses that I was coughing so much I wasn't holding oxygen in my body. So I was kind of disoriented, and also just coughing out more air from your body than you can take in causes a lot of problems as well.
And I think those are some of the basic main symptoms we're hearing about: fever, coughing, trouble breathing.
Yeah. There's a big, long checklist. And I think that's why it took us several days to kind of connect the dots with me. Because when you look at all the COVID-19 websites, there's a lot of symptoms to check off. There's everything from abdominal pain and vomiting and things like that. And I didn't have any of those. So there's a lot of symptoms that could be a variety of things. So no one particular set of symptoms is the one standard, other than the coughing and the the fever, because any infection, you're going to have a fever. And I think that may be one of the things why it's a little tough for some people, especially if they have a mild case, to determine if it really is COVID-19. because there are so many different symptoms that vary from person to person.
How did you end up going to the hospital?
The first time I went in, I was taken in, and all they were doing at that point was just wanting to do the test. They've got kind of a nasal cavity scrape that they do, and they wanted a test, and then they told you to quarantine, and then they wanted you out of the building. By the end of that week, my coughing and my symptoms were so severe that my family just said, "You're going back to the emergency room." And that's when I was admitted. So I can't even really say I 100% made that decision. My family said, "You're going." And once I got in, the doctors and nurses said, "Yeah, you're checked in for a while. This is not good."
At the start of this, did you even have any idea this could be coronavirus?
At the very start, I honestly just thought it was kind of seasonal allergies, because the cough started so mildly, and the fevers kind of made me question a little bit, but I was feeling fine when I woke up in the morning. So it really took, we've read about the lag time in the symptoms. It really did take a little while for those symptoms to get aggressive enough to know that something was really wrong.
We're talking with Mike Ferguson. Mike is one of the members of our Entercom St. Louis family. He has a talk show on KFTK. He fills in on KMOX on talk shows, and he's getting over about with COVID-19. We're talking with him about that experience. Tell me, what was it like in the hospital for you, Mike?
It was really kind of surreal. Now, a few of the days I was in the intensive care unit, and Fred, I'm going to be really honest, those days were kind of a blur because I was just kind of really kind of in tough shape at that point. But it doesn't take very long for you to realize how serious this is, not just for you, but for everybody else, because of the regimented process that the nurses and doctors have just to walk into your room. And they're very honest about it. They say, we have to protect ourselves and all of the other patients who are here in the hospital. So they have like three layers of protective gear, goggles with a face shield over the top of it, with a mask, with gloves, with everything. And they have a very regimented process when they leave the room even. You know, some layers get left in the room. Then there's a handoff with somebody out the door. They've got to coordinate it all. And it's kind of sobering to know that all of this is because of this thing I'm breathing out of my body, you know, that it could be that dangerous to somebody, especially somebody who's elderly or has another compromised health situation. But the nurses and doctors, you know, other than when I was in the ICU, said, we're going to minimize our contact with you and everybody else. So you really only see somebody about three or four times a day when they bring in medicines and check your vital signs and bring you food and things like that. And it ends up really hitting you hard that, wow, this thing is really, really dangerous. I am a kind of walking, talking danger to people if I were not quarantined in this room.
How about those around you, family, friends, colleagues, everyone safe?
Yes, thankfully, thank God. My wife is a professor here in town at Lindenwood University, but she's a visiting scholar at Wake Forest University in North Carolina this semester, so she's not been exposed. My daughter did drive me to the emergency room, so she was, but her quarantine period runs out like this week, and she's not showing any symptoms. I have not been in the radio studios here in town since I went to Chicago, so thankfully I was not around anybody at Entercom. And for the folks that I worked with in mid-Missouri when the symptoms started, none of them have shown any symptoms as well. So I am really thankful that everybody is safe, because it's a pretty awful feeling, Fred, knowing that even though you didn't have any symptoms and you didn't know, the idea that you could have hurt your friends and your family and your colleagues is pretty awful. So I'm really thankful that it does not appear that I infected anybody else.
We're so glad you're doing well, Mike. And you're a pretty young guy, aren't you?
I'm 48. By most standards, yes. By my 21-year-old daughter's standards, I'm ancient. By everybody else's, I'm young.
By my standards, you're very young as well. any pre-existing conditions that might have caused a problem?
I don't think it caused a problem. I mean, I do have a heart issue that's called SVT, which just means that I occasionally deal with palpitations in my heart. It's not a coronary disease or anything like that. But that's one of the reasons I think I got moved to the front of the line at the hospital. But I don't think that had anything to do with the effect that the COVID-19 virus had on me. It was just an additional complication to watch out for when I was there. The body has an electrical system, as I've learned in the last couple of months, and for whatever reason, mine misfires and causes palpitations on occasion. I had that happen one time while I was in the hospital, but we were able to get a handle on it within minutes.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for sharing your story with us, and we're so happy to hear that you're doing well. What message do you have for our listeners? What do they need to know?
Take the warnings seriously. We are a month and a half or so into hearing wash your hands, keep away from people or social distancing, stay at home. We've heard this so often now. I think it starts to become trite and cliche in people's minds. And I would just say, I do not want your weeks ahead to look and feel like the last couple of weeks that I've had. Please continue to heed those warnings and protect yourself and your family.
Mike Ferguson, thanks so much for talking with us. Really do appreciate it, and hope you stay on the road to recovery.
Thanks, Fred. Hopefully I will see everybody soon.
Good deal. Look forward to it. Mike Ferguson is a member of our Entercom St. Louis family. He has a weekend show at one of our sister stations, KFTK, and fills in from time to time as a talk show host here on KMOX. When we come back, we'll find out about a new study at St. Louis University School of Medicine to treat COVID-19 patients. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Researchers at St. Louis University School of Medicine are studying some possible therapies for coronavirus. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Sarah George. Dr. George is a SLU Care Associate Professor of Infectious Diseases at St. Louis University and the principal investigator of this trial in St. Louis. Dr. George, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
So tell us, what is this new trial?
This is a trial that is sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, and it is a study of a very promising antiviral medication against COVID-19 disease. The medication is called Remdesivir, and it is made by Gilead Pharmaceuticals.
And what does the medication do?
What the medication does is it interferes with RNA viruses' ability to replicate themselves. Coronavirus is an RNA virus, and if the virus cannot replicate itself, you've essentially stopped it in its tracks. So it is an antiviral that works against a lot of RNA viruses, and including coronaviruses, in both test tube and animal models.
Has it shown any potential yet?
Well, it's certainly shown potential in animal studies, and in fact, of all the potential medications out there, this one is the best studied and has the most promising data behind it, which is why the NIH chose it for this treatment trial.
So how will the trial work?
The trial works is that we are studying it on consenting patients who are hospitalized at St. Louis University with COVID-19 disease.
So this isn't a volunteer trial. You just can't volunteer for it.
No, you can't just volunteer for it. It's an IV medication only, for one thing. You have to be in a hospital to get it. And for a lot of logistical reasons, it could only be done at St. Louis University Hospital. It is a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, which means that we're studying remdesivir versus a placebo control. We don't know what people get, they won't know what people get, and that's the best way to find if a medication actually works.
Are you excited about this?
Very.
What gives you hope?
What gives me hope, again, is that of all the medications that have been proposed against coronavirus, including some of that have gotten a lot of media hype, like hydroxychloroquine recently, this one actually looks the best in terms of all the data we have to date.
Yeah, tell me about some of those other studies. There's a lot of them that are going on right now. It's sort of a scattershot approach.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, in this situation of the pandemic, that's certainly understandable. But it's also a little bit concerning that hydroxychloroquine has gotten all the media attention it has when, frankly, the data for it are very, very weak. In the small Chinese study of hydroxychloroquine, people who got it didn't do any better than people who didn't get it. And that's pretty much true in the French study, also very small. There really wasn't a clinical benefit to it. There was a slight decrease in viral shedding. And that's literally all it really showed.
We're talking with Dr. Sarah George. Dr. George is an associate professor of infectious diseases at St. Louis University and the principal investigator of this new trial getting underway in St. Louis. Dr. George, as an infectious diseases specialist, talk to me about the need for good science.
Well, without good science, you don't have good data. And without that, you simply don't know whether something is going to work or not. You know, there's sadly been a certain amount of, I guess I have to use the word scam talk or scam artists, propounding all kinds of silly things on the internet. You know, people need to have confidence that if they're taking something, it might actually be beneficial to them. And that's why we need good data to say, is it working or is it not? Or are the safety issues just unacceptable?
What's the timeline for your study?
Well, the good news is that since this study is also being enrolled at 60 other sites, maybe more than that now in the United States and internationally, we'll probably have it fully enrolled within the next couple of weeks. That means we'll have all the people in it that we need to have to try and figure out whether or not it's actually going to work. So I don't know for sure when we'll actually have the data on when it's going to work, but we should have a clear answer on that within, I would say, maybe a couple months.
And then possibly it would take even some more testing before it's made available as a regular form of treatment?
Again, that decision is up to the FDA and not me, but given the situation, I think the FDA would be very receptive to data that it was safe and effective.
Dr. George, what's your message for people that are hearing all these stories about coronavirus and COVID-19 and are scared? What can you tell them?
Well, we have to be cautious. We are in the midst of a major outbreak of a disease that is spread from person to person by respiratory droplets. And as you know, the outbreak has been terrible in New York City, but it's also in the exponential growth phase in New Orleans and multiple other sites. And we're certainly seeing the case number rise rapidly in Missouri. So people need to be careful. Do not get together in groups. Wash your hands a lot. Plain old soap and water is fine. You don't need Purell, though you can use that. Stay away from anyone who is ill, and anyone who is ill should self-quarantine unless they are sick enough that they need to go to the hospital.
Do you think we're getting it? Do you think we're understanding the seriousness of this situation?
I think a lot of people are. A lot of people are self-quarantining, staying at home, which is very important if you're either age over 60 or have any underlying health problems like diabetes or high blood pressure or anything worse than that. And I think the grocery stores are offering special hours to those people. I think some people aren't getting it because they choose not to.
Is the testing in your trial underway now at St. Louis University Hospital?
Yes.
So you are seeing patients and giving patients this new medication?
Yes, we are. And part of a double-blind placebo-controlled trial, half get the drug, half get a placebo. We don't know which is which. And that's the best way to determine whether or not something actually works. You just have to compare and see if it actually has a benefit to it.
And Dr. George, tell us again about remdesivir. What is it?
Remdesivir is an antiviral medication made by Gilead Pharmaceuticals. It is a drug that interferes with the virus's ability to reproduce itself. Remember, a virus only can live and infect other people if it can reproduce itself. Other than that, it's done for.
And has this been used in any other situations?
It has been used in Ebola trials in Africa, and it's also been studied in 168 healthy people and has been found to be acceptably safe.
Dr. George, thanks so much for your time. Really do appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
SLU Cares' Dr. Sarah George is an associate professor of infectious diseases at St. Louis University School of Medicine and the principal investigator of this trial in St. Louis. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll take a look at another possible COVID-19 treatment. This one is in a study getting underway at Washington University School of Medicine. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Researchers at Washington University School of Medicine are also studying a possible COVID-19 treatment. This one would involve the transfusion of antibodies from recovered patients' blood. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Jeffrey Henderson. Dr. Henderson is an associate professor of medicine and of molecular microbiology at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Henderson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So explain to us, what is this possible treatment?
This is a treatment from a century ago, and the idea is that we can use antibodies from somebody who's developed immunity to COVID, and we can transfer those antibodies through blood plasma to somebody who is at risk for developing COVID or who is in the early stages of the disease.
So how did you get talking about it again?
This was through some informal discussions with a colleague at Johns Hopkins University and at Mayo Clinic in Minnesota about a month ago. And in our discussions, we decided this had some merit as something we could use early on in the course of infection that we anticipated would move to the United States would really maybe serve as something of a stopgap measure until things like vaccines or effective drugs could be developed.
And tell me how well this has worked in the past, in what situations?
Yeah, the history of this goes all the way back to diphtheria in 1890 when it was first attempted. So this was an age before all the vaccines we know from childhood and so forth. It had good success for that disease in the 1930s. Again, before the measles vaccine was available, it was used in locations to stop outbreaks of measles by transferring serum, in this case, from people who'd recovered from measles to those who were exposed. It has been used more recently in Ebola and in the SARS outbreak in the early 2000s, and has had, particularly with SARS, some studies indicated that it was useful in helping people resolve the disease faster.
So tell us exactly how it would work.
It works. The nice part about this, and the reason we think it could be used quickly, is that it works just like standard plasma donation. So really no difference. This is plasma donation, and the thing that's special about it is it comes from a donor who has recovered from COVID. And the recipient, of course, is somebody who has been exposed to it or who is in the early stages of the disease. But otherwise, it's the same thing blood bankers have been doing for a long time in the U.S.
So where are you now on this idea?
Right now, the FDA has allowed physicians to use this on very ill hospitalized patients on a case-by-case basis. The big issue at the moment is establishing a supply of plasma from donors who have recovered from COVID, and that's where a lot of our energy is right now, working with national blood banks and a wonderful team of physicians across the country.
So how would that work? You'd have to ask these recovered patients if they could donate their blood?
Yeah, that's exactly right. At the moment, the people who are qualified to donate are those who have had a positive COVID test in the past and are 14 or more days away from the resolution of their COVID symptoms. That is not a large number of people who were able to get the test and who've recovered, but unfortunately, unfortunately, that number is going to increase in the next few months here in the U.S.
Any testing going on here at Washington University?
We are just establishing a registry for donors. That is not yet approved, but we anticipate being able to do that in the next week.
What's the timeline on something like this? It seems like this might be easy to get up and going right away.
Yes, it is. The timeline on getting the donations, I think, has shortened quite a bit because of cooperation of groups like the Red Cross, who are capable of collecting plasma. And our big bottleneck at the moment is just a requirement that people get tested once more for COVID to make sure that they're negative for the virus at the time of donation.
Dr. Henderson, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Jeffrey Henderson is a professor of medicine and of molecular microbiology at Washington University School of Medicine. We also wanted to get an update on the shortage of the drug hydroxychloroquine, which is now being tested as a possible coronavirus treatment. But there's now a shortage of the drug, which is currently needed by lupus and rheumatoid arthritis patients. Here to talk with us about that is rheumatologist Dr. Alfred Kim. Dr. Kim is co-director of the Washington University Lupus Clinic. Dr. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
What's the latest update on the supply of hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine medicines?
In the St. Louis area, it remains low. We're still getting calls from our patients saying that they are having trouble refilling them, although not all patients are having trouble. Particularly those that have been going through Express Scripts. They've been doing a good job of trying to secure their supply chain. One new development that's a negative has been that CVS pharmacies are now requiring pre-authorizations for hydroxychloroquine. So what this means is that they are going to evaluate the medical necessity as opposed to the physicians. This happens sometimes with certain type of medicines, but rarely does it apply to people who've been receiving a medicine such as hydroxychloroquine chronically. They're clearly trying to better control the supply that they currently have.
Tell us about the people who need these medicines every day.
Yeah, so we use hydroxychloroquine primarily in patients with systemic autoimmune diseases. The main ones that we use it in are systemic lupus erythematosus, rheumatoid arthritis, and Sjogren's syndrome. Particularly in lupus, this is really the cornerstone of our therapy. It's the one drug that has been the only drug that has been shown to improve survival in patients with lupus, and it has dramatic effects on reducing disease activity and damage to organs. There's also good data in rheumatoid arthritis and Sjogren's that, in terms of reducing disease activity too.
And why the shortage?
So the shortage really is a reflection of the the perception that hydroxychloroquine is effective for COVID infections. There has been data that has been generated from France that suggests that this may be the case. The proper interpretation of those data is that it warrants further investigation. The problem is that people have been interpreting it as if this is a cure, and more worrisome is that people are now starting to use this to prevent being affected by coronavirus. There's absolutely no data to support this preventative use. And this really puts a huge burden on the supply chain because there are going to be many, many more people who are going to be using it preventively as opposed to those who have already been infected.
And some doctors in the past were stocking up on it?
Yes. So we've confirmed a couple reports of some physicians who've been stocking up on it. There have been more reports nationally where hundreds to maybe even thousands of pills have been hoarded by providers. This is, in my mind, a clear abuse of their prescriptive powers, and you know, I deem it unethical.
So what do you think needs to be done?
So there are going to be several things that are going to be required. I think that there are going to be more and more states, at least in the U.S., that are going to provide restrictions on prescribing it. I think this is an important first step because it defines these limits of when and who can prescribe them. Our recommendation is that in terms of outpatient prescriptions, that the prescriptions are limited to rheumatologists and also dermatologists because they see a lot of lupus patients too. In terms of new prescriptions or refills. The other thing that needs to happen and is happening right now is increase in the supply chain. There has been a rapid response to this that occurred last week, and so we should start hopefully seeing the fruits of that response within the next couple weeks to next month. The third thing is that we need to continue to educate the public and also policymakers that irrelevant use of hydroxychloroquine for coronavirus needs to stop. And again, part of this may be reflected by having increased restrictions being put into place.
We're talking with Dr. Alfred Kim. Dr. Kim is a rheumatologist and co-director of the Washington University Lupus Clinic. Dr. Kim, let's get back to the testing of this drug for coronavirus. What are your concerns there?
So there have been a handful of studies that have come out, most of them from France, two major studies from France by a scientist named Didier Raoult down in Marseille. The first study was very small, but it was suggested that it may work. The problem was that in that particular study, there were other factors that were at play that could also explain why people that received hydroxychloroquine did better. For example, the people who did not get better actually had more virus in the back of the nose compared to the people who did get better at the beginning of the trial. So this opens up the alternative explanation that the amount of virus that people are having in the back of their nose actually may also predict outcome in the future and not the medicine. This was not controlled for. In their subsequent study, which was a larger study looking at 80 patients, there was actually no control arm. In other words, everyone in the study got medicine. So the issue there is that we don't know if this is if their data showing that hydroxychloroquine administration helped with coronavirus infection we don't know if that was just part of the natural course of the disease or reflected the treatment protocols at that hospital, or actually indeed demonstrated effect from hydroxychloroquine. All of these possibilities are open because the data and the study design wasn't able to be able to delineate these causes. So in our minds, again, the best interpretation is that it warrants further study. The over-interpretation would be that this is a treatment for coronavirus.
Dr. Kim, thanks a lot for your time. Really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Alfred Kim is a rheumatologist and co-director of the Washington University Lupus Clinic. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of this show again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the Radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at this same time for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.